So I want to thank a member up in Chicago who recommended a book to me this past week called If I Get to Be Five by Dr. Fred Epstein, MD. I recommend the book for everyone, but I want to mention that a number of examples that I'm going to use today came from that source. Fred Epstein was the chief of children's neurosurgery at his hospital here for many years. He was at the top of his field. He was probably as successful as a man could hope to be. And one morning, as he was riding his bike, which he used to do every morning, 20 miles a day, his front wheel hit a hole, and he went flying over the front handlebars and hit head first on the pavement. And it rendered him unconscious. He was rushed to the closest hospital, and even wearing the helmet that he was wearing, he suffered severe cranial injury, and he was in a coma for 26 days. After the 26 days, he awoke, and there he could feel his wife's hand on his, but he was unable to move his fingers, and he was unable to speak. He was unable to even breathe without a ventilator. You know, he was completely, if you can understand this, feeling completely helpless in this condition. And he understood, however, one, what I think is a vital truth, and that truth is this, that while he felt hopeless, he knew he could never allow himself to feel hopeless at all. He was no longer the doctor. Now he was the patient. Now he was a patient, and he knew what lay ahead for him. There would be hours, there would be weeks, months, and maybe many years of painful rehabilitation that he would go through. He was going to have to learn to breathe on his own again, if you can imagine that. He was going to have to learn again how to swallow, how to talk, how to walk. And he thought, as he went through this, of what he had learned through the number of children that he had helped during his career up to this point. Let's go over to Matthew 18, if you will, Matthew 18. He had learned much from their examples, and now he was going to have to call on that which he had learned from them. And I suggest to us today that all of us can learn from the examples of children. Matthew 18 and verse 1 says this: at the same time came the disciples unto Jesus, saying, who's the greatest in the kingdom of heaven? And Jesus called a little child unto him, and he set him in the midst of them, and he said, truly I say unto you, except you be converted and become as little children, you shall not enter into the kingdom of heaven. Whosoever, therefore, shall humble himself as this little child, the same is greatest in the kingdom of heaven. And whoever shall receive one such little child in my name receives me. And so we have to become, he says, as little children when it comes to entering the kingdom of God. But what exactly did Jesus Christ, what exactly did he mean by this statement? What are some of the things that you and I can learn from children? You know, for years, this doctor of neurosurgery had learned from other doctors, and he had learned from technology. But now he was going to learn from what he thought was a very unexpected source. He was going to learn from some of the children who had been his patients. You know, he admits that children have to depend on their parents, and that their parents are responsible for their protection and their safety and guidance and so on. But he also admits that, you know, there's a lot we can learn from them, and their persistence, their reliance, their innocence, and the love that they have in their heart is something all of us can profit from. And he writes this in his book: what I've discovered again and again is that children can model courage and character for adults, if only we pay attention to them. People tend to think of children as weak and vulnerable, as fragile little people. But in my experience, they're giants. They have immense and open hearts. Their minds can expand to encompass almost any reality. Their bodies and souls are amazingly resilient, and their spirits can soar in the face of enormous physical and psychic pain. What we often mistake for fragility in children is their openness to experience. I believe, he says, it's this quality of openness, of heart and mind and spirit, that makes children so resilient in the face of life-threatening illness or any other obstacle that comes in their path. Now, he says in his book that he learned this from a girl named Naomi, who was 4 years old, 35 years ago from this time today. She entered his hospital in a severe, a grave condition. That she evidently had been born with a tumor in her brain, and over the 4 years, that tumor had grown and entangled itself in some of the blood vessels of the brain, and one of those blood vessels was broken, and it began to bleed, and that blood put pressure on her cranium so that she was rendered comatose. And in a coma, she was rushed to the hospital. And there, he said, back in those days, they didn't have all the tools that they have today. And as a result of this, he was almost afraid. You know, he didn't know what to do exactly. But he decided he would take a two-part plan to work with Naomi. That first, he would drain the blood and the pressure off her brain. Then, if she revived, he was going to perform a second surgery on her to try to deal with the tumor and remove it from the brain. But he knew, of course, that it would cause some injury to her brain by doing so. Eventually, Naomi regained consciousness, and he still talks about the first time he entered her room. Her head was swathed in bandages, as you can well imagine, and she said something to him, and it was this: "If I get to be five, I'm going to ride a two-wheeler." And he visited her daily, and each day she would stand up on her bed as she was regaining strength for the surgery, and each day she would have another expression for him. "If I get to be five, I'm going to beat my brother at tic-tac-toe. You know, if I get to be five, I'm going to be able to tie my shoes in a double knot. I'm going to learn how to do that. And if I get to be five, what I'm going to do is I'm going to learn to jump rope backwards." But you get the point. The doctor was amazed at her sense of determination. You know, here was a girl, 4 years old, who realized, "I may not make it to become five." And yet she had a determination, and she had a persistence, and she had a vision of a future. And she kept raising her own bar. And you know, sometimes kids are able to do that better than parents and older people. Sometimes they can bounce back from trials and troubles easier than some of us, you know. But she kept raising her bar, and you see this even from the time children are little babies, that they start to use their hands to try to feed themselves on their own. They don't have to be taught, do they? And they start to crawl, and then they raise the bar to walking. And nobody teaches them to do it. They do it themselves. They raise their own bar. And that's what Naomi was doing, and that's something she taught him. And he decided from her example, "I'm going to have to raise the bar for myself." So the first thing he did was start to set personal goals. He repeated to himself over and over again, "If I get back on my feet, I'm going to sail my boat again." He said, "If I get my right arm strong enough, I'm going to play catch with my son." He said this: "If I get my speech back, I'm going to get to go back on Tuesdays and argue with the doctors over their techniques." He said, "If I get back to myself, I could become a surgeon again." You know, I think it's a beautiful point, isn't it? But the question I have today is, what about you and what about me? You know, what about us? Every single one of us experiences a setback of one kind or another. You know, can we make ourselves, or can we then learn the experience from this experience of Naomi? Can we learn to set our own bar and raise it? You know, I know that when I was called earlier and I was working in the refrigeration industry, I was called into the office because I had made a mistake. And there they explained to me what had happened, and I apologized for it. And here's what the general manager said to me. He said this: we all get knocked down sometimes. That isn't the issue. The issue is, what do we do after we get back up? And that's so true in life. I remember Philippians 3, if you will. I remember Dick Ames in college, when we went to Ambassador College, he had his own mantra. And his mantra went something like this. In fact, it didn't go something like this. It went exactly like this. Never give up, he said. Never give up. Never, ever, ever give up. And his mantra, I think, was a very, very vital one and a very, very true one for all of us. You know, here's the issue. When we grow up, we tend to slow down a little bit. We get our jobs, we sometimes become parents, and we settle into where we are, and we get ourselves our recliner, and we kind of sit back, we get a big screen TV, and we get certain programs that we like to watch and so on. You know, but the point is this: do we settle in where we are and stop raising the bar for ourselves? Is that something that we do? Because I think all too many of us have done that. And we've settled in where we're at, and we should learn the lesson of Naomi. You and I were called from the beginning to make Christian growth, weren't we? And we were told not to be entangled in the world because we're running a race. And so we need to remember that. It's active, this life, this calling that we're involved in. You know, the Apostle Paul didn't accept the accomplishments he made in the world. He didn't accept the accomplishments that he made spiritually in his own life. But he kept raising the bar for himself. Why? Why did Paul just keep doing this, no matter what happened to him, whether he was stoned or whether he faced animals and beasts? Why would he raise the bar? Because he could envision our transcendent goal. And here's what he said in Philippians 3, beginning in verse 10. He said, the reason was that I may know him and the power of his resurrection and the fellowship of his sufferings, being even conformable unto his death, if by any means I might attain the resurrection of the dead. Not as though I had already attained, neither were already perfect, but I follow after, if that I may apprehend that for which I am apprehended of Jesus Christ. That is why he was called. Brethren, I don't count myself to have apprehended, but this one thing I do, forgetting those things that are behind and reaching forth unto those things that are before, I press toward the mark. He presses towards the mark of the prize of the high calling of God in Jesus Christ. You know, we accepted our calling with its challenge for us to grow in the faith. Have we settled somewhere where we are and just sat there? Have we just accepted our lives the way they are now? 4-year-old Naomi did not. At 40, she writes the doctor, still to this day. When she's in New York, she goes to visit him, and she says that, you know, it was hard learning to ride a bike. It was hard learning how to skip rope. But now she's able to be, not the job that every girl might envision for themselves, but she's able to be a clerk in a store, and she's happy with her life. She's happy with the progress that she's made, and she's continuing to make progress. She's continuing to raise that bar. Let's go over to Hebrews 12 for a moment, because I think we need to learn the example of this marvelous 12-year-old here and set the bar higher. We need to focus, if you will, on our own mantras. And we should be saying something like this to ourselves. If I make it to Passover, I'm going to overcome that sin that has been so easily besetting me, that keeps coming back. You know, think about this. If I make it into the kingdom, I'm going to eliminate corrupt politics. If I make it into the kingdom, I'm going to be able to help people who are suffering in pain. If I make it into the kingdom, I can put an end to war in some parts in the world. Just think of it. If I make it into the kingdom, I'm going to stop child abuse and their suffering, and stop these kinds of cancerous brain tumors and diseases that children have to endure because of our polluted planet, you know? But my point is this. Don't you think we should fill our minds with these kinds of thoughts? That we should raise the bar because of our transcendent purpose? Because I think we should. You know, we should fill our hearts and minds with this kind of motivation, because the hope of a better future is what motivated Naomi. The hope of a better future is what motivated the Apostle Paul, and the hope of a better future is what motivated Jesus Christ. Hebrews 12. Hebrews 12 and verse 1. All of God's people have been motivated by this vision. Wherefore, seeing that we're compassed about with such a great cloud of witnesses, let us lay aside every weight and the sin that does so easily beset us, and let us run with patience the race set before us, looking unto Jesus, the author and finisher of our faith, who for the joy that was set before him endured the cross, despising the shame, and is set down at the right hand of the throne of God. And so you get the picture. Jesus Christ endured a great deal of suffering, and he did all of that for us, and he did it because he could see the future of the family of God and you in it. And he was willing to do what he did for all of us. Look at Chris Lambert was another one in the book that I think can teach us a profound lesson. He was a very talented, likable kind of guy, you know, that had a very big heart, and people could see that in him, but he also had a malignant brain tumor as well, and that tumor just wouldn't quit. They took it out, it grew back. They took it out again, it grew back again. They took it out again, and it grew back again. Over and over, it was rapacious and malignant, this tumor, and it was sucking the life out of him, and the doctors did all they could, but eventually they ran out of options, and he ran out of time, and he died, and the doctor lost him. But a little while after his death, his mother sent a poem that he had written to the doctor, and when the doctor read the poem, he was quite shattered by it and changed his life. Now here's what the poem said. I'm struggling, O Lord, to stay alive. I'm losing my strength. I'm living in a life of confusion, and death is very near. I ask you, reader, whoever you may be, take my trembling hand and warm it with care and with sympathy. I believe, he wrote, that love is the sole purpose of man's life. Without love, life is sterile and without meaning. But with love, life has wonder to it. With love, life has color and it has beauty. It's a wonderful poem, isn't it? James 1. Imagine reading that if you were his doctor and lost him. But when Dr. Epstein read this poem, it shattered him. It devastated him. He had done everything he could to save this boy's life, but he found that he had ignored his deepest need, and that was simply to be loved. You know, it just sounds so simple, doesn't it? But most of us, I think, fail to this. We fail in this to one degree or another in our personal lives. You know, each one of us want to be a genuine Christian, and we want to serve. You know, we don't want to be selfish. We want to give to others. but we don't always know this simple truth of what it is they really need. Everybody, every single person in life needs this. They need to feel like they're loved. I remember being a deacon many, many years ago, and the church had various programs, and one of the programs was we were at a lawn mowing crew. I was in charge of that lawn mowing crew. You know, I tried to get a small condo at the time so I didn't have to mow my lawn. They put me in charge of the lawn mowing crew for all the widows, and so I mowed their lawns. And we often went out and we unplugged their sinks, and we, you know, sometimes helped them move. I was also on a moving crew, and we did all these things, you know, and we did them as an act of Christian service, but we did them sort of clinically, not really realizing this truth that what those widows needed besides fixing the sink. You understand, we went there and talked, you know, with them, and we're practicing our spokesman's club skills. You know, we weren't thinking of them, and we weren't doing it in love and giving them that kind of sense of caring for them. It was fulfilling a need, but it was doing it by squeezing it in our crowded schedules to get it done. We all knew this scripture, James 1 and verse 27. Pure religion and undefiled before God and the Father is to visit the fatherless and the widows in their affliction and to keep ourselves unspotted from the world. Well, we kind of interpreted this that we were to visit them and fix things that they needed being fixed, you know. So we visited them and we did this, we fixed it, but we didn't really think, as so many young men don't, to show them that we loved them, that we cared about them. We weren't just doing this because it was a duty. John 13. You know, keeping ourselves open to another person's pain is hard enough, but keeping ourselves open to a person's emotional pain is sometimes much, much more difficult, much harder for us, you know. And the doctor said this. He said he doesn't think of it anymore as compassion being something that is passive. Instead, he says he thinks of it as something that is extremely active, and that it is actually an act of courage to be able to do this. And he said this for this reason. He said that to risk identifying with someone's suffering is actually to risk breaking your own heart. It really is true. To understand them, to empathize with them. You know, the doctor said it's harder to do that than to actually make life and death decisions in the operating room. To be able to be with them and feel their pain with them, you know. So, as a result of this poem, Dr. Epstein decided to open his own hospital. And 108 people of the staff of where he was working followed him in this, 108 people, because he believed in the philosophy that he was talking about, a new hospital with a completely changed philosophy, and that was that we were going to give love as well as medical expertise, and each patient was treated with unconditional concern by the staff. Man, that was a difference. But I say this, isn't that what church is supposed to be like? Aren't we supposed to give that to one another here in this congregation? By this shall all men know that you are my disciples, if you have love for one another. You know, I think God's church is to be a place of healing. So why don't we learn the lesson that life and death can teach us? You know, the congregation, I believe, should be a place where we exhibit unconditional care for one another and each person. I remember reading a study years ago, or a year ago maybe, about outliers. Outliers are people who live outside the norm, people who are not part of the normal group. as we see it. And there's one particular group that I remember reading about that came to mind. There was a number of people who had the longest life expectancy of anyone in America. And when this was found out, a number of sociologists and psychologists and others went to study this group of people. They were a group of people who had long ago migrated to America from France in a mining community, and they had established a small village and in America. And what happened was these individuals went to study to see what gave them this long life expectancy. So they, of course, thought they'd look at their diet. So they looked at their diet and they found out that these people were as overweight as everybody else, that they ate as much fat and as much sugar as everybody else. They looked at their habits, their living habits. They smoked about the average of everybody else. You know, everything. They looked at their working conditions. They looked at the air they breathed. They looked at every conceivable aspect of these people to see what was it that made them different. Was it their constitution? No. Well, what was it? They couldn't understand. And then one man noticed something about them. He said, when the men will be walking down the street, they'll stop and talk to the vendors. They knew them personally. They would go and talk to the barber on their way home and just go in and chit-chat. And what he found out was that these people in the village all came from the same location. They all had the same cultural background. They all had the same kind of beliefs and the same language. And they really cared about one another. And they all knew one another. And they were integrated as a people. And they said that was the only difference that made their life expectancy longer. They genuinely had concern for one another. They liked each other. And they got along well. And I go back to this, you know what? You and I are outliers. We're not like everybody else. And it's not because we're great or anything, but it's because we're called of God. And it makes us and makes our lives totally different from everybody else's life. And we share a common culture, biblically, don't we? And we should be a place, a home, as it were. I say la hospice. Place to come together, to gather together, and we should be able to feel accepted and cared about in our little community of the Church of God, in every church. The separation that's going on now is a travesty to the Church of God, that we should be a place where people can come for healing and so on. You know, it's a great lesson, the sense of well-being that they had. And we should learn from that. On another level, altogether different in a way but similar, we're forced to live today in Satan's world. As a result, you know, in the third world, some people struggle for survival, and others live on a very meager sustenance just to survive in some third world countries. In our country, we're a developed world, and we have almost everything, and yet we have another malady that's a little bit different, and it's this. We live in a world of technology, and people today more and more are having relationships with machines rather than one another. It's a world of obligation. It's a world of speed. It's a world of deadlines that we have to make. We live in a world where our schedules are incredibly crowded and where we're often behind. We're overbooked. We're overloaded. We're overworked sometimes. And time simply rushes by us. How many times have you ever thought about a child suffering in pain? Because a little child suffering in enormous pain, the minutes crawl by so slowly. And when a child of a parent is in trouble and sick and maybe going to die, that parent's time stops. It just stops right there. Everything hangs on that moment they find out. You know, Dr. Epstein explained in his book that it didn't matter how many lives he saved, it was the ones he lost that haunted him. he felt like it was a personal failure on his part to lose the life of a child. But he had to come to accept something to be able to continue in his work. And that was this. Sometimes all he could do was buy some time for a child. And this truth taught him a very important lesson. And he wrote in the book this, "I know that calculating the value of life in days and years is a fool's arithmetic. The only true measure of our lives is how richly we spend our allotted time and how much of ourselves we share along the way." That's really beautiful, I think. Laura was 15 when she got a malignant tumor that grew back for the third time, and the doctor didn't know what more he could do for her. She had already had two very difficult and painful operations, and she had been through all the chemo protocols and all the vomiting and the sickness that it brings with it as it destroys the cells in your body. You know, he said something about this. He explained this. He said, "Sometimes when kids are sick, parents try to hide the truth of their condition to them." And he said, "In these kinds of situations, honesty isn't the best policy." He said, "It's the only policy with kids, that they feel betrayed when parents hold back the truth from them." I remember even back when I read that, I remember the time I was a kid and I got in a fist fight with another kid because he said there was no Santa Claus. And I remember my mother had told me, you know, there was. So I told him, I said, "My mother said there was." And the betrayal I felt when I found out the truth about that. And so I can kind of relate to where these kids would feel that same sense of betrayal to not be told the truth about their condition. So look, Epstein laid it on the line with this little 15-year-old girl. And he showed her the x-rays and let her decide what she wanted to do. And he explained that another operation would buy some time, and that's all it would do for her. And she asked him, you know, she said, "I want to go in the worst way to writing school one more summer. If I get the operation, do I get summer?" And he said, "I feel pretty confident that you will. You'll get summer." And she said, "I want to do it." She recovered from the surgery quickly, and she had made an agreement with the doctor, no more chemo, but the surgery. So she recovered fairly quickly, and she went off to camp in June. In July, she sent a letter back to the doctor in which she said that she was riding a palomino and grooming it. And then she wrote later in August of a ribbon that she won for jumping the horse. And she was so proud of that. And she sent a picture of herself with her arm draped around this golden, beautiful horse. And in September, she came back to the hospital and the headaches were back. In October, she died. And there was a lesson that he learned from this that I think we can learn as well. If you'll go over to Ephesians 5, there is the sadness of this, but in her life, there is a lesson for us to learn as well. As adults, we sometimes lose this ability that children have instinctively, and that is they're able to live in the moment. They're able to live in the moment, and they're able to get the best from the moment. They're not trapped by the tyranny of the urgent and the schedules that we find ourselves trapped in as adults. You know, as adults, we sometimes fear the passage of time. We don't like to think about the aging. We don't like to think about the infirmity of it. We don't like to face the fact that we're going to ultimately succumb to the claim of death. You know, sometimes we'll actually be in denial as we live in our lives about this claim. We act as though there'll always be a later time. You know, we'll always be able to get around to do those things we intended to do. And we deny that there isn't eternity for us right now. And so sometimes we read what I think is an important command, and I think we don't give it the kind of respect that we should. And it's found here in Ephesians 5, in verse 14. "Wherefore he says, awake you that sleep, and arise from the dead, and Christ will give you light. See then that you walk circumspectly, not as fools, but as wise. Well, sometimes people in life go, and even in the Church of God, they go through life as though they're sleepwalking. They're going through the motions, but they're not in the moment. They're not really a part of life and what's going on around them. They're unaware of their allotted time. What should we do? He says this, redeeming the time because the days are evil. And that's what we should do. Rescue the time from loss. Rescue it. Value deeply the kind of time that we have in this life and use it. Use that time within God's will, the only best and good and right way to live. In verse 17, wherefore, don't be unwise, but understanding what the Lord's will is. And don't be drunk with wine wherein is excess, but be filled with the Spirit. What a waste to be drunk with wine. I'm not saying you shouldn't have a drink of wine or be merry from it, but some people spend their lives drinking, numbing themselves from the pain of life that they experience. Speaking to yourselves in psalms and hymns and spiritual songs and singing and making melody in your heart to the Lord. And I remember sometimes when I was feeling down, when I worked in air conditioning, I'd walk across the roof singing the songs we sing at church. Because you know why? They can make you feel happy. Music is a wonderful, wonderful gift. And it can make you change your mood and you can become happy by singing. And then he says, giving thanks always for all things unto God and the Father in the name of our Lord Jesus Christ. Yes, we should seek to live our lives, you know, by God's Spirit and not waste it in various dissipations. Live a life of gratitude for all we have. Wouldn't it make us different? We should, I believe, realize this and live a life of gratitude. I ask you to think today just for a moment about the air you breathe here in Montana. It's so beautiful, the air. It's so wonderful to be able to breathe. But it is a miracle, isn't it, that we're alive, that we have life, and that we enjoy the wonderful food that God has made for us, and that we should appreciate the friends that have been our friends through thick and thin, and the fact that we have, all of us have loved ones. What an amazing thing in life. We can reason, we can plan, we can make that plan come to pass. We can give it life, can't we? Like this doctor gave it life when he started a new hospital, you know? To me, all of this is part of God's wonderful gift to us, the gift of life. And it springs from his eternal and divine grace, that is, his giving nature. And we simply cannot, really, we must not, we should not take it for granted. We should appreciate it. Like those who realize I only have a little bit of time left to live, and they live it to the full. They make their bucket list, and they go through the list, and they do the things that they want to do, and they show the love to others that they should show and want to show to other people. Enjoy it. Enjoy all that he's given us, and love others without boundaries. Epstein tells another interesting story about how parents can learn from children and who are sick. And he speaks of a woman who was watching her daughter sleep in a wheelchair, and she was, was an upset sleep because of her condition. But she watched her daughter sleeping there, and she confided to the doctor this. And here's what she said. I used to be like every other perfectionist parent. I wanted Allie to be a better student, a better musician, whatever it was that would make me prouder to be her mother. It wasn't until she got this tumor that I realized that a miracle she is, and a miracle that she's always been. Now all I want is the chance to keep loving her and to have her in my life. Wow, that's so much insight. Too bad a child has to get sick before we feel it. You understand my point? I think one of the greatest lessons of all can be found in this statement. We may not appreciate a child, or we may not appreciate a mate, until we fear to lose them. We are so preoccupied with the person they're not. Boy, he makes an important point here, doesn't he? John 10, if you would. So I'm saying we should be showing appreciation to our loved ones now while we have them. Why don't we try being more considerate? Why don't we attempt to be more loving? Why don't we try to tell people more, I love you. I do. I really do. I care about you, you know. Why not show it to them while we have the chance? Why not attempt to be more demonstrative towards our loved ones? You know, I ask you today to consider just how valuable each and every person we know is. Every person we know, converted or not, has the potential to be the child of God, to actually be God. Everyone has inestimable worth and value to God. You know, think of how much He values each one of us, you know, even before we ever knew of Him. You know, even when we were in our sins and defied Him in those sins, He still loved us. He wasn't looking at all our mistakes and condemning us for it. When Christ came, He said, I didn't come to condemn the world. I came to save the world. And He did it through His love. John 10, verse 7. In 10, verse 7, then Jesus said unto them, truly, truly, I say unto you, I am the door of the sheep. All that ever came before me are thieves and robbers, but the sheep did not hear them. I am the door. By me, if any man shall enter in, he'll be saved, and shall go in and out and find pasture. The thief comes not but for to steal and to kill and destroy. I'm come that they might have life, and that they might have it more abundantly. Well, Jesus Christ came, and He went through all He did that we might have life more abundantly. And what does that mean? We're going to have more money? We're going to get a raise in pay, a promotion at work? What does that exactly mean? Things going to go easier for us? We're going to have a yellow brick road to the kingdom, and it's going to be an easy path for us to follow? You know, what does it mean? Are you going to be more successful than the next guy because you believe in Jesus Christ? What's it mean to have life more abundantly? To me, the answer to these questions I've asked is obviously no. No, it's not. Christ came that we might appreciate what life is really all about, so that eventually we could have His Spirit and we could actually look through His eyes and understand things the way He understands them. He came so that we could appreciate the way life was built and intended to be and the way it was intended to be lived. And we can learn who and what God really is and what He has done for us. He came so that we could understand how much we mean to God, and so we can understand all He has done for us. Back in verse 11, I am the good shepherd, and the good shepherd gives his life for the sheep. But he that's a hireling and not the shepherd, whose own the sheep are not, he sees the wolf coming, and he leaves the sheep and flees, and the wolf catches them and scatters the sheep. The hireling flees, because he's a hireling and cares not for the sheep. But him, I'm the good shepherd. I am. I know my sheep, and I'm known of mine. And the Father knows me, even so I know the Father. And I lay down my life for the sheep. Jesus Christ probably suffered more than any of these children ever did. Remember, He emptied Himself of His majesty, His magnificent beauty, and the power that He had, and He became one of us, made out of flesh and blood and helpless as a child. Then He grew up, and He grew up and lived a perfect life in the midst of insults as to His birth. He lived with rejection from His peers and from His own family, in many cases His siblings. Says He was a man acquainted with grief and suffering before He ever died. He was that way. More than we can know. 33 years of age, he came to a point in his life that was the moment he was born for. And he was arrested, and he was bound, and he was faced with an illegal trial in which they hurled terrible insults and accusations on him. They spit on him. They covered his face. They beat him so he couldn't see who was hitting him, and they pulled out his beard as they struck him, and he allowed himself to be beaten beyond recognition for you and me. Bent over the post, he wasn't able to move to assuage even a single blow of the lictor. And those lictors were professionals, and they knew how to take a man right to the point of death. And sometimes when men would go unconscious, and they would throw water on them to wake them back up, and so the beating could continue. They didn't have any humane laws like 40 minus 1 that the Jews had. And so he allowed himself to be beaten in this way for us. And then he was nailed to a stake. Our Creator nailed to a stake. And the only way he was able to breathe was to lift himself up, putting all the weight on that nail that was in his feet. Ultimately, he died for us. That's how much he loved you and how much he loved me. It's more than anyone ever has, and it's more than anyone ever will. And Jesus Christ, it says, learned by the things he suffered. You know, people's lives are often changed when they endure suffering. And the kids who experience suffering often become stronger inside because of it, stronger individuals. Parents often speak, I'm sorry, of being able to draw courage from their own children's examples and the suffering they go through. And they're able to draw hope sometimes from these kids. But when it happens to them, when suffering takes place, there's generally something that follows it. And it's this: people become changed people as a result. Do you know how they become changed? They become sensitive now to other people who are living in crisis. They learn compassion. And so some people will help out after they recover. They'll do volunteer work. Others even change their professions, and they'll organize groups, and they'll lead others to help serve others who are in need. And by such actions, they do this: they redeem the pain. And I believe that's why God allows us to go through suffering in life. Sometimes we think if we obey God, we won't have to suffer so much. We think we'll bypass it because we love God. We obey Him, so He'll take care of us and make it easier for us, you know. You know, He suffered terribly for us, and the reason was that he might be a faithful high priest. And so I say it's probably just the opposite, that we suffer so that we too will learn to be compassionate in our judgment, because that's what he did. He learned to be compassionate as a high priest and stand up for us, intervene for us, and say, Father, the flesh is weak, because he knows what it's like to feel the pain. So you and I, we go through pain. We go through trials, and we go through suffering in the lives that we lead. And it's for this very reason, because eventually we're going to be able to turn that suffering into compassion. We're going to come back here, and we're going to shed that compassion on others in the judgment we use. And we learn compassion from those experiences that we have in this life and on this earth. You know, we learn not to condemn others for the mistakes that they have made, you know. And all that we experience, good and bad, it's all going to work together for good in the end. And that's why it's here. 2 Corinthians 4, we'll finish up over here. 2 Corinthians 4. All of it, all that we suffer, all the trials that you and I will go through in this life, you know, are preparing us for something of enormous consequence. We're going to become the bride of Jesus Christ, and He is preparing us now to be like Him. He's preparing us to be able to love and help people in the world. 2 Corinthians 4, verse 17. He says this, "For our light affliction, which is but for a moment, works for us a far more exceeding and eternal weight of glory. While we look not at the things which are seen, but the things which are unseen. For the things which are seen are temporal, but the things which are not seen are eternal." Yes, we may suffer now in this life, but again, I remind us, it is for an enormously important and great purpose. You and I are the children of God. We are. We have a magnificent destiny. And so I ask us today to learn some of the things we can from these examples of children and from these experiences that they've had. And so I remind us to keep raising the bar in our Christian walk. Keep raising it with greater hope. Keep raising it looking to the future. But also appreciate everything that we have right now. We don't get to have it forever. We're just going to have it for a short amount of time. Why not live in the present? And why not live gratefully for what we do have? It's all a miracle if you understand it. And let's not fear to go through suffering or to go through trials. Don't fear them, but redeem them. Redeem them by turning them into compassion and love for other people that we can share. So I ask us here to strive to be a congregation that will be, in part, a hospice. It is a place where people can come to get well, a place where we can learn from children, as it were, and remember that we can continue to learn to be the children of God.